Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your slizzy slurpee of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Nibbling on sponge cake, watching the sun bake. All of those two.
Even if you are not of a certain generation and of a certain disposition and a certain psychosocial approach to the world, you undoubtedly know that what we were just listening to was Margaritaville. Judging by how my voice sounds, I could probably use a trip to Margaritaville. I'm feeling a little bit congested today. We are going to spend some time talking about a musical icon who passed away recently. That is Jimmy Buffett. Buffett built an empire on the back of that hit. Jimmy Buffett toured constantly. Jimmy Buffett had a dedicated fan base called Parrotheads, very much in the spirit of Deadheads. Jimmy Buffett built a business and an empire from restaurants to retirement communities on the back of the Margaritaville idea. Jimmy Buffett was also sneakily influential when it comes to the country music of the 2000s, especially, and also came from a context of country rock that's often erased when we think about the music that Jimmy Buffett was making. Buffett also had more complicated songs and put out albums and records that were not about the relaxations of island life and coastal life, but were about slightly broader, more political, more existential concerns. But Jimmy Buffett is often reduced to one note in discourse as far as what he contributed to popular music and beyond. But John Prellis knows that Jimmy Buffett is way more complicated than that. JP, welcome. And first of all, I've never seen you in a shirt like this. I just want to say, I've known you for more than a decade, never seen you in a shirt like this. Tell me what's going on here.
I hope you can hear me. My shirt's kind of loud.
Hey, yo.
In honor of Jimmy Buffett, RIP, I am wearing a Hawaiian shirt that has electric guitars, orange flowers, and a Woody and palm trees. Matt, listeners.
It is a wild thing to see you wearing this shirt. How does one acquire a shirt like this? This is generational, I'm going to guess.
This is definitely generational. It's actually a Hawaiian shirt made in Hawaii with wooden buttons.
Wow.
Genuine Hawaiian shirt.
Did you wear this shirt as you listened to Jimmy Buffett songs, or is this fresh out the package feeling brand new?
No, it's not brand new. I have worn this shirt to review Jimmy Buffett songs this morning.
Wow. Wow. Okay. You have to be the change you wish to see in the world, I suppose, is maybe the way to think about it. JP, if Jimmy Buffett could even get you into a Hawaiian shirt, the man clearly wielded an unbelievable amount of power. Can you talk about Margaritaville before we get to everything that came from it? What about Margaritaville as a music spoke so widely? And how also was it in discourse when it came out with the music of its day?
It was on the countryside at the time. There's another song where he talks about wearing hush puppies and not being a glam rocker. I'm sure it was originally marketed to country stations and then became a pop hit. It's an odd piece of music because it's got steel drums, it's got marimbas, both of which became trademarks for Buffett in all of the copycat songs he wrote that sounded like Margaritaville afterwards. But it's also a sad sack song. It's about a guy alone. He's messed up his romance. He's walking on the beach. He's cut his foot on the pop top from a beer can, and he's back in the shack running the blender to make a frozen concoction. So there's this sense of, I've had a bad time, but I've earned this drink, which I think is the takeaway that made Buffett's career. I've earned this drink. I deserve this. I deserve to get drunk and messy and so what?
An anthem of American resilience, I guess is what you're saying.
Also an anthem of, I worked hard, I deserve a break. And Jimmy Buffett, for a lot of people, was the break.
And eventually that becomes obviously not simply a musical proposition, but one about the lifestyle proposition over time. Jimmy Buffett, prior to Margaritaville, had come out of a country rock context, which was the type of music it seems like that he was making prior to that era, was not totally out of step with he wasn't a total novelty before Margaritaville.
No, he wasn't. I think his original proposition was to be a storyteller and come up with scenarios where he could also indulge his sense of wordplay. But if you listen to some of the early songs, there's one called The Great Filling Station Holdup, which is about two clowns who hold up a filling station with a pellet gun, don't get much for it, but end up in jail.
We got $15 and a can of STP. Big old jar of cashew nuts and a Japanese TV. Feeling we had pulled the biggest heist of our career. We're wanted.
I think he came out of that sort of folk rock country storytelling tradition of people like John Prine and Steve Goodman. He wrote songs with Steve Goodman, and he wanted to tell stories like he told in The Great Filling Station Holdup. I don't think he wanted to be just songs for drunks. But on the other hand, he did write the classic college dorm anthem, Why Don't We Get Drunk and Screw? That was early on.
Honey, why don't we get drunk and screw? Why?
I guess some of the conversation with Jimmy Buffett is really, are these songs about getting drunk and letting loose, or are these songs about the reasons that people get drunk and let loose? That's the tension, to the degree that tension and Jimmy Buffett can exist in the same sentence. That is the tension in the songs. And there seems to be a persistent undertow of whether it's I've worked too hard, I'm set upon by a tragedy or some kind of setback. The brightness of the music often stands in contrast to some sad through line in the lyric.
He did do a lot of just let's get drunk songs. Cinco de Mayo in Memphis. We're talking formula here. But he also, I think, had other ambitions, one of which was his whole sailing and coastal vibe. I think he loved the ocean. He seriously loved the ocean. He has a song called Treat Her Like a Lady, which is about just respecting the elemental power of the ocean. He actually has a lot of songs like that. I think he really cared about coastal cultures. In some ways, he wanted to unite New Orleans, Trinidad, St. Lucia, the Bahamas. I think he wanted to bring together, and coastal Mexico, I think he wanted to bring together all of those coastal sounds. He did very cleverly call his music Gulf and Western, as in Gulf of Mexico. But it was also clever wordplay because he was recording for ABC Dunhill, which was a subsidiary of Gulf and Western at the time. He was not a dumb guy.
He had business on his mind. He had business. When Margaritaville took off, tell us a little bit about how that hit becomes a template for what Buffett ends up doing. Because if you go through whether it's Buffett's greatest hits or sort of like the most popular streamed songs of his on Spotify, there very much is a template, as you sort of alluded to earlier. How does that hit take on a life of its own and create a scene where a song is a Buffett song? It's not a genre song. The genre is Buffett.
There's a great story in the New York Times Magazine by Taffy Brodesser Ackner, which talks about how all of the franchising and licensing came to him. Probably from the stage, you realize the song is a sing-along. And then when people want to sell Margarita TM things, you realize there's more to it. But Buffett was always a savvy businessman. He always had a total work ethic. The whole idea of wanting to lie around in a beach shack eating oysters and drinking margaritas was actually not his lifestyle. He did an attempted Broadway musical and a flop Broadway musical. Before he did Escape to Margaritaville, which was the flop Broadway musical, he did an attempted Broadway musical called Don't Stop the Carnival, which was based on a novel by Herman Wouk, which was about a New York City public relations guy, but Buffett's music used carnival rhythms. It didn't make it to Broadway, but it was kind of ambitious. It was literary. He always cited a lot of writers in his songs. Louis L'Amour, he cites James Jones. He really loved to read. And I think he saw himself in a storytelling tradition even when he realized that he could just follow the formula and write another song about going to a city and getting drunk, which he wrote a lot about.
Does it matter that it was costume on some level? I guess I would venture to say the hundreds of thousands of people who buy the music, you know, stream the songs, go to the events, go to the Margaritaville TM restaurant in Times Square, very close to our office. I'm not sure if it matters if it's costume, but I don't know. What do you think?
I think people wanted a grain of connection. But no, the effect matters more than the authenticity, for sure. That's popular music. My theory of art is you get everything you put into the song and you get everything everybody else puts into the song.
And gets out of it, don't you think?
Yeah, puts into the song and takes away from it.
And that's also, we talk about criticism a lot and what the point of criticism is. And it's the point of criticism.
Does it have a point?
Don't give it away. Don't tell anyone. But it's not simply about what the artist shows up to provide. It's what one can pull from. That's where the thing lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can we talk about some other sort of signature Jimmy Buffett moments? Because I feel like even if he is doing reductio ad absurdum, let's get drunk type songs, somehow there are a few of those that stand out. I know we'll get to some of the deeper cuts and less expected Jimmy Buffett stuff later, but maybe let's talk through a couple of the Buffett standards, as it were, the ones that everybody associates with the man.
Let's talk about A Pirate Looks at 40, which is one of his storytelling songs. It's about a friend of his who in the past smuggled marijuana on his boat and feels himself growing older and feels himself missing his swashbuckling lifestyle, but also realizes he can't keep it up. It's another one of these wistful, I want to be back on the ocean, but I've earned my rest kind of songs. Maybe that's the Jimmy Buffett motto. I've earned my rest. I've earned some relaxation. But A Pirate Looks at 40 is very wistful. It's not boastful. It's not, I had these exploits. It's, I missed them. I don't think I could do them again.
Let's listen to A Pirate Looks at 40.
Yes, I am a pirate. 200 years too late. The cannons don't thunder. There's nothing to plunder. I'm an over 40 victim of fate.
I also feel like that kind of, how would you describe it? The way that it's, that a certain mode can be transmitted over time, or how it evolves over time. When I was listening to some Buffett to prepare for this, A Pirate Looks at 40, I was listening to, and then I was also listening to Son of a Sailor, and thinking a lot about how an approach to life grows and changes in an individual's life over time, but also is transmitted again generationally. And I think part of the Margaritaville proposition is that this is something that can be almost like handed down. Obviously, we did an episode pretty recently about the Dead & Co. and Deadheads, and there's a lot of multi-generational, cross-generational fandom, with whether within families or friend groups or whatnot. Parrotheads, which we have not yet, you said the word Parrotheads, but here we are, Parrotheads. I wonder if it functions similarly. I wonder if it's a family affair. You know, I have to confess, I have not ever been to a Jimmy Buffett concert. I feel embarrassed to say that. I don't know if you remember this, like early when I was with the paper, I did review a late period Jimmy Buffett album when we were still doing like a lot of album reviews. Like I reviewed a late period and I remember being like, damn, this is good. Like this really, like it's honed. It's exactly what it's supposed to be. Like, it's not something I've returned to necessarily, but I remember I was like pretty impressed, all things told. All right, so we talked about A Pirate Looks at 40. What about Cheeseburger in Paradise? Talk to me about Cheeseburger in Paradise.
Well, Cheeseburger in Paradise actually feels like a storytelling song. It feels like he's invented this character. If you actually listen to the verses, which nobody does, it's about a guy who's trying to go vegetarian. He's eating sunflower seeds. He's tempted by the burger. And then the end of the song is everything you could possibly put on a cheeseburger and how great it is. He gives up, but there's a tension there. There's, I know I should renounce this pleasure, but I deserve this pleasure. And so he takes it. It's not simply give me my cheeseburger. It's I've longed for this cheeseburger for 70 days.
I like mine with lettuce and tomato. Hides 57 and French fried potatoes. Big kosher pickle and a cold draft beer. Well, good God almighty, which way do I steer for my cheeseburger in paradise?
That era of Buffett. So at this point, we're late 70s, right? Like all these songs, all the kind of quote unquote big songs really came from a period in the late 70s. At those, are these hits? Like Margaritaville is a hit. I know Margaritaville is like a real hit, but like to what degree are these other sort of secondary and tertiary Buffett classics actually cross genre, pop crossover hits at the time?
Margaritaville was the only top 10 hit. I think it went to number 8. The others probably were hits on country radio. Like the Grateful Dead, you don't need a string of hits if you have loyal fans. And by then he had loyal fans. So they were hit enough. I don't think they had to be, like top 40 smashes. They reach enough people.
It's a funny way to think about how fandoms are created. Because like, I think historically, especially for me, generationally coming out of the 80s model, we think of super fans coming from like real pop stars, like huge, like touching every part of the potential fan base. And that's how you make hits. That's how you build fan bases. That's how you build careers. But hit enough is actually a very, I think, elegant way of describing something like Jimmy Buffett or the Grateful Dead or whatever, where it's like maybe it doesn't register by the metrics that the other hits are measured by. But it touches like pachinkos its way to just the right people who really take it and hold it close and then build a world around it. So hit enough. That's JP. That should be a book. You should write that book. Now that we've talked about it, someone's liable to, might as well be you.
In my spare time.
Yeah, for real.
But I mean, the other word people use to describe that is a sustainable career.
Yeah.
Where you have loyal followers and you keep producing things that they really love, that are maybe niche, but reach enough people to keep them happy. I mean, someone like Bonnie Raitt, someone like Tom Waits, if he ever goes back on tour, please go back on tour, Tom, I'm waiting for it. People like that, people like Nick Cave, who have reached people who really want to hear what they have to say next. And I'm not sure Buffett actually reached that many people who wanted to hear what he had to say next, because he always went back to his big 8 songs. Everybody knew if you go to a Jimmy Buffett concert, you're going to get those songs.
Did you at any point review a Buffett show?
I did, actually.
What era are we talking?
Probably, I didn't start at the Times until the 80s, so it was either probably 80s or 90s. It was at Jones Beach Theater.
By the water.
People were wearing shirts like mine.
Yep. What was the vibe?
It was party time. It was just everyone is getting up and swaying and doing bad baby boomer dancing. The thing that struck me, though, was at Jones Beach, the ocean is right behind you.
Yeah. Behind the stage. Yeah.
Behind the stage. But he had a backdrop.
So he blocked out the ocean. He blocked out the ocean. He was like, not my ocean.
Yeah. Not the show that I am prepared to give.
That's funny.
He had a great band, the Coral Reefers. Great wordplay, were a really solid band all the way through his career. You can hear just blues and gospel and zydeco and calypso and bolero and all kinds of stuff in that band. He wasn't faking that. He wasn't coasting. That band really
Again,
knew how to
another
play.
Another good
pun. Oops.
But this is the second time you brought this up, and I think this is actually something that's underappreciated about Buffett, which is, you were saying he wanted to unite coastal areas, whether it's from the Caribbean or coastal Mexico, New Orleans, etc. But that's a sonic diaspora as well. Those sounds are traveling across the water, not simply people traveling across the water, but sounds traveling across the water. What exactly were the through lines that he was drawing that really to make some one singular coherent approach? What was he borrowing from? You mentioned Zydeco.
So Zydeco, he's borrowing from, Calypso.
He's borrowing reggae a little bit.
A little Junkanoo from the Bahamas. Steel drums from Trinidad Tobago. There are a lot of steel drums in his songs. And I went back and forth on Buffett thinking sometimes these were tourist trinkets. I brought back the souvenir, you hear a steel drum, therefore there's a beach involved. But from people who talked to me after he died, he was seriously committed to island cultures. He was a big fan of Cesaria Evora. He wasn't just dropping by and taking the trinket. He was really immersed in it. He was also immersed in really bad unintentional puns. He also cared about the ocean, you know, about the ecology of the ocean, about preserving the ocean. He was serious about that too. And that's an important thing. If you listen to a song like Trying to Reason with Hurricane Season, and it's a song about hanging out on the coast, a hurricane's about to blow in, he's got to finish a song, but it's really about how awestruck he is by the power of nature. And he's a small guy writing a song, hanging in there, but he's also facing winds and water.
So all alone I walked back home, sat on my beach, and then I made up this song. And now I must confess, I could use some...
He understood the splendor of nature. He wasn't... I sometimes think the worst excesses of Buffett are justifying being a tourist. Let's go to the beach and leave our plastic cups in the sand and get drunk. But I don't think he himself felt like that. I don't think he wanted to justify that. I think he really cared about the environment he was singing about.
In the way that, like, you almost can't choose your fans, but the next layer of that is you are maybe not responsible for your fans' behaviors or penchants. I think about this maybe more in the context of stan culture, and maybe parrotheads are stans. I don't know. Maybe it's an older version of stans. Could be. But when I think about a person like Jimmy Buffett trying to tell medium level subtle stories about the burdens that people go through that then cause them to seek out relief. Let's say, obviously some songs are just about the relief, but if there's an undercurrent and if people only draw from that, the relief, to what degree is it your problem? Like, are you supposed to go on stage and say, I just want to say before I play Margaritaville that this song is about sadness. This is a tragedy that I hope you have a great time. Like, is that Jimmy Buffett's job? I'm not sure it is.
No, I don't think it is either. His live shows did tend to stick in songs that were direct. He has a song called A Lot to Drink About. Great wordplay, right?
Yep.
And you expect it's going to be like, bring me another whiskey. And instead, it was a political song about the news in the Bush era. I mean, he mentions Afghanistan. He mentions Bush and Cheney. He was serious about what he wanted to say, even though he knew he was also bringing the party.
We're only talking simple greed. And those Somalian pirates are counting all their gold while Bush and Cheney ain't around. And all the good lookers seem to be Russian hookers from Key West to London town.
Can we talk a little bit about later Jimmy Buffett? Like, at what point does Margaritaville Incorporated really start to take over the Buffett oeuvre? Obviously, we're talking late 70s into 80s, but he becomes a real business, I guess, by the end of the 80s into the 90s, this is an industry now.
Yeah, but he doesn't ever let himself get entirely taken over. There's always an oddball song. I mean, title song of one of his albums, Beach House on the Moon, is, of course, it's a Jimmy Buffett song. It's got a beach house in it. But it's this crazy intergalactic fantasy, free associative, crazy song. He's got a song called Waiting for the Next Explosion, which starts with the invention of dynamite and turns into a song about fear of nuclear war.
Wait, can we listen to that? I've never heard that song.
Waiting for the Next Explosion.
Okay, let's get into that. Jimmy Buffett has chained himself to the nuclear reactors. Let's listen to a little bit of this. I'd like to hear it personally.
Teach all our school children about civil defense. Don't be scared. Do
not cry. Just dive under your desk and kiss your ass goodbye. Oh, such a dangerous world.
Do these songs, these more unusual, more pointed political songs, have any genuine common shared DNA with what we think of as mainstream Buffett, core Buffett?
Only the wordplay, I think. He always loved wordplay. Last Mango in Paris. The weather is here. Wish you were beautiful. He always loved his wordplay. His first album, A White Sport Coat and a Pink Crustacean, based on the Marty Robbins song, A White Sport Coat and a Pink Carnation. And even the songs that turned into like big fan sing-alongs, dance-alongs. He has a song called Fins. Now, when he sang
Fins, that's one of the bigger records.
Yeah, that's one of the big eight. Fins had the people up and dancing, doing fish moves. But the song itself is about a pretty girl walking into a bar and getting swarmed by bros. It compares the flock of annoying suitors to sharks. That's what the song's about.
But now she lives down by the ocean. She's taking care to look for sharks. They hang out in the local bar and they feed right after dark. Can't you feel them circling, honey? Can't you feel them?
To my understanding of pop music from the 80s and the 90s, Buffett remains, again, a niche concern, like a very popular niche concern in his circle and in his scene, but not necessarily in discourse. Especially, he's coming out of country and country rock, and you think of the mainstream country of the 80s and 90s, it's much bigger, it's more arena focused, it's Garth Brooks. It's not playful nor small in the way that Jimmy Buffett was making records. And apart from Margaritaville, my first true exposure to Jimmy Buffett was actually via Alan Jackson, a big country star of that era, you know, the power country era, but also someone who maintained a through line in his music of, how can I put this, like slight Southern slowness in the music. Like, it was never always as big. It had moments, but there was like he maintained a kind of like earthen groundedness, I think, throughout his career. And Alan Jackson had a covers record. I think it was in the late 90s. And there's a Margaritaville cover on there, which, whatever, fine. And Jimmy Buffett, I think, is on that. But the real breakthrough moment, and the thing that really puts Buffett back on my radar, is It's 5 o'clock Somewhere. And this is when I was listening to a lot of mainstream country in the 90s and 2000s. So I heard a lot of It's 5 o'clock Somewhere. Let's listen to specifically the transition point in the middle of the song when it's coming from Alan Jackson to Jimmy Buffett.
I could pay off my tab, pour myself in a cab, and be back to work before two. At a moment like this, I can't help but wonder, what would Jimmy Buffett do?
Funny you should ask, Alan.
I'd say, pour me something tall and strong, make it a hurricane before I go insane. It's only half.
Okay, so I used to watch CMT a lot. So effectively, the song is like, first half is Alan Jackson, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, I need a drink, etc. And then the second half is Buffett, and Alan Jackson like is in a bar, maybe, or and then he like opens a door and then like magically is on stage with Jimmy Buffett. It's like a card cut and he's on stage with Jimmy Buffett. And I just remember thinking, like, I don't understand this at all. This doesn't register for me in any real way. I didn't understand the scene. I didn't understand the relaxation. I personally do not enjoy the beach at all. It was a little bit of a head scratch. But then I was thinking about it in the broader context of the country music of that moment. And especially Kenny Chesney, who is Buffett on steroids. Is it safe to say that Chesney is like Buffett on steroids a little bit, at least to my ear?
I think he's the Cliff Notes Buffett. No shirt, no shirts, no problem. He's just the relaxation.
Yes, there might not be any existential dread hovering underneath Kenny Chesney songs, or at least not any kind of dread that will be understood in our lifetimes.
There still isn't. It's 5 o'clock somewhere. That guy who wants to get drunk, he's worked a hard day. He's totally frustrated. That's very Buffett, that song. Even it's written
very
by Alan
so.
Jackson. But that guy has earned his drink.
But it's also interesting how especially the Chesney business model feels very indebted to the Buffett business model. The songs are a little bit more tailored for country radio of that era. And again, Alan Jackson, Kenny Chesney took the bigness of the 90s, late 80s into the 90s power country and injected some of that relaxation that seems to have been pulled from the Buffett era and built, Chesney especially, built a huge business on the back of that.
They gave it back. Let's talk about Buffett's 2004 album, License to Chill. Thank you, Beastie Boys. But actually, I think the whole Buffett motto is giving people a license to chill. It's great wordplay, but it's also, that's what he did. He said, you've earned it, you can chill now. But this album is duets. It's got Alan Jackson, it's got Clint Black, it's got Kenny Chesney, it's got Martina McBride, and it's got Toby Keith, George Strait. But it sounds like that big Nashville arena country.
It's the biggest, quote unquote, Jimmy Buffett album, sound-wise.
It doesn't sound like the Coral Reefers. It doesn't sound like the Gulf Coast Cruise. It sounds very corporate Nashville.
Should we play the hit on that record, which is Hey Good Looking?
Let's do the non-hit. Let's do Sea of Heartbreak by Jimmy Buffett and George Strait.
Two great tastes that taste great together.
So divine, I wish you were mine again, my dear. I'm on the sea of tears, a sea of heartbreak.
So the thing that I remember thinking at the time was like, oh, you know, you think about genre that have become much bigger over decades, going back to reclaim their undersung heroes or maybe people who didn't totally get all the benefits. And obviously, Jimmy Buffett's plenty rich by this point. He's not hurting. They didn't have to go find him in a shack in Montana somewhere. But I thought maybe this was the beginning of a real big mainstream country run for Jimmy Buffett. I'm like, you're on this Alan Jackson song. You have a full album, mostly of collaborations with the biggest stars, and of two or three legitimate big hits. And yet, Buffett effectively retreats a couple years later back to where he was before, performing his shows for his audiences on his terms. Do you think that's a proactive choice on his part, or do you think that, in essence, they couldn't hold? Like, to play at that different level just was not where he was at, or was not going to be received that way?
Actually, I think it's a better move.
Less fickle.
He's not trying to be trendy. He's not making music that his band doesn't want to play. He's in his comfort zone, but he's also just, I can be Buffett. I don't have to be another Nashville act. In the deep cuts on his later albums, he keeps experimenting. There's a sweet one called Barefoot Children in the Rain, where he's thinking wistfully about childhood and innocence, but also in the context of a harsh world. There's a song called Everlasting Moon, where people hijack the moon to change the tides. He still has this ambitious literary streak that, you know, he can indulge while going on the road and playing the Big Eight and watching the Parrotheads dance to Fins.
Do you feel that the average Jimmy Buffett fan, even this at this late stage, how dialed in are they to his quieter ambitions, do you think? Or do you think it just floats right past? Sails right past, one might say.
We are one with the puns today.
We sure are.
I can't look in other people's heads.
Trust me, I try. I certainly try.
From what you see of concert footage, it doesn't seem like introspection is a big feature of those shows. Who knows? Maybe they're going home and listening to those deep cuts.
Also, Jimmy Buffett had a political valence, which is not necessarily as remarked upon. Jimmy Buffett was a Democrat, from what I can gather. Performed for pro-Hillary benefits, took swipes at Trump. Maybe there is an implied political valence to songs of the nature that he is best known for. But we know perfectly well there are plenty of people whose personal politics don't necessarily align with the way that their music is received or the type of music they make or the fans even of the music that they make.
It's the Born in the USA paradox.
Very much so. So to what degree does it matter that Jimmy Buffett did have a political perspective? And what are the ways in which it informed quietly the types of records that he wanted to be known for?
I did mention that song, A Lot to Drink About. He's got songs about how he hates cell phones. Some of it is boomerish complaints. But he does recognize the modern world as being complicated and annoying. He was topical. Let's just say it wasn't a commercial move for him to be topical. But he still dropped them on the albums.
Yeah, and also, like, I was frankly surprised to learn that he had made some comments that were critical of Trump. I would have to assume a decent part of his audience was leaning right politically. And there is a little bit of a risk if you're inviting people into this kind of fantasia where all that matters is chasing your next drink and relaxation and turning off the stressors of the world. There is like a tiny bit of risk associated with that if you are also in certain places in bits and bobs saying, and actually the direction the country is going in is not great. There might be some people who don't agree with that. And I guess I wonder if that's, I'm not calling Jimmy Buffett a quiet radical, but I do wonder if he thought about that. And I do wonder if it struck him as a potentially something that could undermine Jimmy Buffett Incorporated. Because Jimmy Buffett Incorporated, it feels predicated upon, we don't talk about that stuff.
Yeah, but except that he did in the song. So I think he really balanced the sort of smiley-faced, beach ball-kicking, margarita-in-hand persona with what he wanted to do. And I think at a certain point, the empire took care of itself, because if you want a margarita, you go to Margaritaville in Key West. Why not? And I don't know that people listened to Cut 11 on his albums of the 2020s. They were happy with Margaritaville.
Let's go out on an old, unexpected song. What do you want to hear?
One of his early songs is called He Went to Paris. It's about a guy who's settled on the beach. It's a storytelling song. It's about an 86-year-old guy who's living on the beach. And he's an American, and it's a narrative. He's an American. He goes to Paris. He marries an English woman. They move to England. During World War II, she's killed by bombs. He loses an eye. And eventually he ends up living by the beach, saying he has no regrets. It's another one of these songs where the character has earned their rest, earned their relaxation, but it's a seriously sad story. And I think that if Margaritaville hadn't become such an empire builder, Buffett would have written more of them, but I think he always wanted to write more of them.
That's our show. Thank you to JP, as always. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Podcast Deluxe is on YouTube. It's tinyurl.com/podcastdeluxe for the full suite of episodes. Subscribe to podcasts. Anyone gets your audio content at Spotify, Apple, YouTube, Google, et cetera, et cetera. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com, with any questions or thoughts. Get in the Discord, get in the Facebook, tinyurl.com/podcast Facebook or podcast Discord. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. He went to Paris.
Jimmy, some of it's magic, some of it's tragic, but I had a good life all the way. He went to Paris looking for answers to questions that bothered him so.